On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I felt like I was doing something wrong. I was making money and I wasn't helping the community. So people in my community were still being shot. My children started gangbanging. My older kids started gangbanging, living the same lifestyle and culture. And at that point, I realized that this lifestyle is not about me.
Gang interventionist Skip Townsend talking about how he went from gang member to community activist in South Los Angeles. It's part two of our series Peacemakers. That's coming up in the show. But first, unions are exhaling a sigh of relief in a California case the Supreme Court handed down today. The justices split 4-4 in Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association. And that means that a lower court ruling stands. So unions can still collect dues from teachers and other public employees, even if those employees choose not to join their union. It was a case that did not look good for unions before the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia. Alan Ides is here now. He's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a former Supreme Court clerk. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I mentioned that union officials were concerned before Scalia's death. How important was this case to the future of unions?
Oh, I think it was very important to public sector unions. It would have undermined their membership and their dues significantly. Their ability to bargain and negotiate would have been diminished across the board.
And it was looking like a 5-4 decision before Scalia's death against them?
Based on the oral arguments, it was looking very much like a 5-4 decision.
Right. And so for a while now, unions have been under attack by conservatives and in the nation's courts and by conservative lawmakers. So how much does this shift on the Supreme Court change that?
I think it changes it significantly. The court was being asked to overrule a 1977 decision that upheld this type of arrangement. And it strikes me as very unlikely that whoever is appointed to the court, whether it's by President Obama or by the next president, is going to be somewhere around the center, and very unlikely to overrule a well-established precedent. So I think they lost the battle and maybe the war on this one.
Oh, interesting. Are there other union cases working their way up?
I'm not sure if there are, but in order for this to be decided, there would have to be one, and it would have to come from, you know, through the federal system. It could move up fairly quickly, but I would say probably not for a year or so, and certainly the court's configuration will be different by the time the case arrives.
So the president has nominated Merrick Garland. He's considered a centrist to fill the high court's empty seat. And do you think that this decision will at all play a role in whether or not he gets a confirmation hearing?
I don't know if this decision will play a role, but my hunch is that there are going to be a few more of these 4-4 decisions in high-profile cases, and the public may start getting a little uncomfortable with a court that is basically unable to do its job. So there may be some pressure on the Republicans.
What are some of the cases that the court could split?
Well, I think there's a good chance that a case argued last week, Zubik versus Burwell, which was a challenge to the Affordable Care Act provision that requires certain actions be taken by religious employers with respect to contraceptive services. And they were challenging the legality of that provision. And from listening to the oral arguments, it sounds very likely that the court is going to split right down the middle on this one.
Right. And this one, that would just that would leave a patchwork of different court decisions in the lower
courts. That would be a problem, because although all of the decisions that were consolidated for Wednesday's hearing upheld the Affordable Care Act, there is one circuit case that was pending before the Supreme Court that ruled against the Affordable Care Act. So we're left with a conflict in the circuits. My guess is that if it's 4-4, the court would hold it over for argument next term.
What about some of the other cases involving hot-button issues like voting rights and affirmative
action? I think the voting rights case, the one-person, one-vote case, it's kind of hard to calculate exactly what the vote is on that, but it could have an impact on that. I'm thinking United States versus Texas, the case involving the president's deferred action program in immigration, is a very, very likely candidate for a 4-4 split. That case hasn't been argued yet, but kind of the lines of political lines of decision, I think, were set up now for a 4-4 split. So that's a big case.
What would that mean if there was a 4-4 split in that case?
That would uphold the decision of the lower court holding that the president's action was unconstitutional. And so that is really troubling. It's very rare that a lower federal court has the last word on the constitutionality of federal action. You know, the Supreme Court always moves in on something like that. So that's going to be very problematic.
And then there's also an abortion case, also a Texas case.
Yes. And again, and an affirmative action case looks hard to really map out the way that one's going. But the absence of Scalia is going to start showing in a number of cases that will be coming down this term. And as I said, I think the public is going to get the perception that without the Ninth Justice, the Supreme Court is simply unable to fulfill its duties.
Do you think that there will ever be a conservative like Antonin Scalia on the court, or at least for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, I don't think in the foreseeable future there will be a conservative like Justice Scalia or a liberal like Justice Brennan. I think that the way the kind of political lines are forming now, it would be extremely difficult to get anyone of that nature, any kind of extreme views of the Constitution onto the court. It'll be a problem for both parties, and maybe that's a good thing. I think it's unfortunate that the court is kind of mathematically split with a swing vote in the middle. You'd rather have a court that is, you know, a little more reflective of a wide range of possibilities, and so I think it's a good thing.
You think it's a good thing that people are more down the center?
I think it is a good thing that people are a little more down the center. That way we get fewer doctrinaire opinions. I think the Constitution has to be, to a certain degree, flexible and represent what the interests of society. And society is not necessarily represented by polar extremes.
Alan Ides, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hollywood has fled California in recent years. States from Georgia to Michigan to North Carolina have lured big-budget productions with generous tax subsidies. 35 states now offer some form of these credits. But now the programs are getting knocked down, state by state, by a conservative political group called Americans for Prosperity. The group is backed by the billionaire Koch brothers. Hollywood is only one of their targets when it comes to fighting corporate tax breaks, but maybe it's the easiest target. Eric Schwartzel covers the film industry for The Wall Street Journal, and he wrote about this recently. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first, tell us more about Americans for Prosperity and why they're interested in this issue.
Well, Americans for Prosperity is a political advocacy organization that is backed, like you said, by the billionaire Koch brothers. And for a long time, their presence was really felt at the federal level. But over the past several years, they've been opening state offices in dozens of locations, from Georgia to Montana to Florida to California. And they really are targeting state legislature that they don't agree with. And one of the efforts has really been against these film tax programs programs that, as you said, are now in 35 states and have made it really, you know, common for productions to move out of Los Angeles and save money by filming in Atlanta or New Orleans or Boston, places like that. And whenever they're going after these corporate tax subsidies, what we found is that they often will begin by going after the Hollywood productions and telling taxpayers, hey, you know, your politicians are giving millions to these movie producers while your schools are underfunded or your roads need repaired, things like that.
Right. And so they had some success in Michigan with Batman v Superman, for example.
They did. Batman vs. Superman, which just came out on Friday, received $35 million in tax credits when they filmed in Michigan. And the group, Americans for Prosperity, really held that up as an example of money that was being diverted, they thought, for silly reasons, especially whenever the overall state budget was not in the best, you know, best health. Mm-hmm. And their efforts really have been underscored by the fact that a lot of these states that have been giving a lot of money to Hollywood would have their own budgetary problems. We saw that also in Louisiana and Alaska, where the falling oil prices have put a dent in the entire state economy, let alone the part of it that has to find the money to pay Hollywood.
Well, and yet the Koch Industries and its subsidiaries have gotten government subsidies worth hundreds of millions of dollars in recent years. Is this a little hypocritical?
Well, that's certainly a point that the proponents of the film tax credit programs bring up. And Americans for Prosperity is very quick to say that this isn't a culture war. Even though it can look like they're going after Hollywood liberals, Hollywood Democrats, they say it's about ending the governmental practice of picking winners and losers when it comes to corporate handouts.
Well, it's interesting that they have, this is not necessarily ideologically one-sided because some liberal groups agree with them.
Exactly. And you'll see that on a state level in several cases where, for whatever reason, a liberal policy group thinks that the money that's going toward these Hollywood tax credits could be better used elsewhere. And so it is definitely a case of strange bedfellows when the Koch brothers, who, according to some people, pick our Republican candidates for president every cycle, are aligning with these groups that want better schools or, like I said, road repair, things like that are often what are cited.
So where is a state where they've focused and they haven't been successful?
Well, they've seen some opposition in places like Georgia, where there really is quite bipartisan support for the program there. I mean, it really is more likely that you'll find someone like Jennifer Lawrence at a Starbucks in Atlanta these days than you would in Los Angeles, because so many major productions are moving there. And they really have enjoyed some pretty bipartisan support. So Georgia, we saw that they did try to sort of make a little, Americans for Prosperity tried to make a little bit of noise and saw that it was going to be tough, but we don't think they're done. We think that they're going to keep trying in Georgia.
Georgia calls itself Yollywood.
Yeah, that's right. They've really embraced their identity as the Hollywood of the East. They call themselves Yollywood. The last time I sat down with Governor Deal was actually at the Sunset Tower Hotel when he was out here, thanking the studios for bringing so much business to his state. It really is like been a perfect storm for supporters of the tax credit programs in Georgia, because Democrats and Republicans alike think that it's been great for them.
Well, interesting. He has said he's going to veto this so-called religious freedom bill that Hollywood said they were going to boycott the state because it looked like it targeted gays and lesbians and was discriminatory towards them. And he said he's going to veto the bill. Is he going to be in trouble for that?
This was a perfect example of Hollywood's scattered production forcing it to grapple with legislation it normally would never have to comment on. Walt Disney Company and AMC Networks led the charge in saying they would leave the state if he didn't veto that legislation. And that is huge, because Disney films a ton of the big Marvel movies in Atlanta, and AMC films The Walking Dead in a small town outside of Atlanta. And both things have been really, economic boons to the state. I don't think he's certainly not going to have any trouble vetoing the legislation in Hollywood. I know that he probably will have some trouble with his own party, because this was legislation that was backed by a GOP-dominated legislature. But he's wrapping up his final term here as governor, so maybe he doesn't care anyway.
Right.
How he goes out.
So I wonder if the Americans for Prosperity, were they behind that legislation at all?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm not sure. I'm not sure, though. But I don't think so.
So all of this actually, perversely, might be good for California because it could halt runaway production.
That is certainly what California is hoping. I mean, California over the past year or so has really doubled down its efforts to lure some of these productions back. It tripled the amount of money that it was going to allocate for its own tax credits. And it's won some success in bringing back particularly television shows, which hopefully come and run for several seasons and employ people over a longer period of time than just a feature film. So certainly this would be in the best interest of California. However, Americans for Prosperity does have a California state office, and I don't think they would be sympathetic to any Hollywood overtures when it comes to getting tax credits, even if it is in California. They seem to be targeting these everywhere.
So maybe these Hollywood studios will look abroad more to film abroad.
Yes, and we see a lot of overseas programs really ramping up their efforts, whether it's in countries like Malaysia, the Dominican Republic, parts of Canada, and Eastern Europe have all been really aggressive in trying to lure Hollywood productions to their territories, and they've been succeeding.
Well, Eric, thanks.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's Eric Schwartzel. He covers the film industry for The Wall Street Journal. And we'd love to know if you have been affected by runaway production. We'd love to hear from you. Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the Saudis are buying land in California to grow alfalfa for their cattle back home. Both Saudi Arabia and California in a drought. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Saudi Arabia is running out of water. This poses a problem for the country's largest dairy producer, the Al Marai Company, because feeding cows requires food, and growing that food requires water. So what is a large agribusiness to do in the midst of a drought? Well, Al Marai and other Saudi companies are buying up thousands of acres of land and water rights in California and Arizona, places, as we know, that are also in the midst of a drought. Joining me now is Adam Keats. He is senior attorney for the Center for Food Safety. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How you doing?
Great. Thanks. Well, tell us more about this company, Al Marai, and its designs.
Well, Al Marai is a large-scale, one of the biggest dairy producers in Saudi Arabia. It's a vertically integrated company. They control and they want to control their production of their hay, their cattle that are creating the dairy, the manufacturing of the milk and the cheeses and whatnot. And they're looking around the world for places to get the forage they need to feed their dairy cows.
And they have set their sights on places here in Southern California and in Arizona. Why?
Well, we have Arizona, California, we have strong laws protecting water rights. So we have these areas, these farming areas in California, they have very old water rights that are protected by strong laws. And we have very little restrictions on what you can do with the water once you get it. And so it's totally, it's kind of up Saudi Arabia's alley to be able to go to the U.S. where we protect their right to the water, but we don't have any government or any sort of regulatory agency telling them, hey, don't grow alfalfa, which is exactly what happened in Saudi Arabia. The government said, Al Marai, you need to stop growing alfalfa. It's a waste of water.
And can anyone buy land? You can be a foreign company, a foreign government, and buy land here?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is the consequence of, I mean, we live in a global marketplace. This is a global marketplace that we created. We do this throughout the world. And so we shouldn't be surprised that other countries with more money and more resources or more need for these resources are going to start buying our land. This is an absolute consequence of our kind of free trade globalization, goals that we've been having the last, bunch of decades.
So the Saudis have been buying alfalfa from California farmers for a while. What's the difference between them buying it and just growing it themselves?
I mean, for a practical purpose in terms of Californians, it makes no difference. We're not going to see anything. Maybe they'll even, it might even improve their efficiency. I mean, maybe they'll have more a longer term perspective on their use of their resources. But I think for them, it's just a security issue. It's guaranteeing their supply. They won't get outbid in the future. They won't. They'll be able to set the use of the land. I mean, one thing it does is we know Almari wants forage. They want alfalfa for their cows. We can now say that farm, those acres in that part of the state are probably pretty definitely there's going to be a strong interest in maintaining them as alfalfa production. There is going to be less market forces influencing a different crop production on those acres now.
Right. And do you think that that's a bad thing?
I think that's a bad thing. I mean, in terms of in terms of hardening demand for water and setting in stone these types of uses, yes. But that's happening throughout California already. We already allow private companies to make these decisions. The vast majority of industrial agriculture in California is controlled by Wall Street-based holding companies and Wall Street investment interests, and they have their own, they have their own goals. They don't necessarily care what's good for the state's water use, what's good for the highest and best use of our food supplies or our water supplies, a diverse food production. Those aren't concerns. What they are worried about is how much money they're going to be able to make off of their investment.
Well, so you think that the government should have a bigger say and more control over what is grown in California and who grows it?
I think absolutely. I mean, this is a classic problem where we're guaranteeing the rights to the water, but we absolutely have no regulation or no control over what they do with it. And these are the consequences. A good example is that we have a huge shift in production in California toward permanent nut trees, almonds and pistachios. And these are very high value crops. They're a great interest to Wall Street and the investment community, but they're not necessarily the best thing for us to be growing in California. What the best crop in any given place, in any given acre or any given part of the state is going to really depend on a lot of different forces. And right now we only let one force really dictate that, which is profit. And these are the consequences.
Right. I mean, well, some would argue nuts are a good source of protein. They pack a great nutritional punch for how small they are.
Almonds? Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about almonds versus alfalfa, and a lot of people are looking, the pro-almond camp is saying, oh, alfalfa is terrible because it's so inefficient and it's such a low-value crop. But alfalfa actually benefits the aquifers. It's actually a pretty beneficial crop for the aquifers, above it. There's a lot of water that doesn't get sucked up by the alfalfa. It goes back and, recharges the aquifer below it. And the other thing is that alfalfa can be fallowed, and this is a big thing in California. Our water supply is, we all know, it's boom and bust. We have these big, long droughts. We have these very wet years. Alfalfa can adjust to that. You can go 5, 6, 7 years without watering an alfalfa plant, and it will pop back up if you put water on it, 5 years after, later. Almonds, pistachios, they need water every single year. And alfalfa, once you plant the seed, you can harvest that the same year, the same season. Almonds take 5, 6, 7 years before the fruit, before the fruit grows and you can actually harvest it. So we've allowed, I'm not necessarily defending alfalfa use throughout the state of California. It's really kind of a site-specific problem, but it's not the boogie crop that I think that the almond industry wants to make it out to be.
Although I can't imagine that the Saudis, once they've bought this land and planted this alfalfa, they're going to let it go fallow.
Yeah, I mean, well, the good question. I mean, it really, really comes down to their water supply. The land that they bought actually has a very dependable water supply because it has a very old right to that Colorado River water. They didn't buy land in the Central Valley, for instance, or in Kern County, which has much more irregular water supply. They bought high value land with a very secure water supply. However, if laws change and if the Colorado Compact changes, or if the water rights change in the Colorado or whatever, there's a lot of different factors that could happen that could interrupt their water supply. If those things happen, their investment's a little bit more secure than if they bought young almond trees and needed to make a profit every year, which is what most U.S. investors are doing like crazy. They're doing this like very speculative investment on nut trees that in any point, if their water supply gets interrupted, they could be in deep trouble financially.
Adam Keats, Senior Attorney for the Center for Food Safety, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think about this? Foreign companies buying land with the water rights here in California. What do you think about globalization and specifically the globalization of food? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how a gang member became a gang interventionist.
I need to be that cushion between the police. The police, of course, know protocol and procedure, and the community doesn't know that protocol and procedures. So it's just a matter of being bilingual.
Making Peace in South LA, our series continues next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There's been a surge of violent crime over the past year in Los Angeles. South LA has seen the greatest increase. South LA is also a place where community members often don't trust the cops. And that's where Skip Townsend comes in. He works with the LAPD to stop gang-related violence before it happens. Townsend is a former gang member, and that gives him credibility with people who don't trust law enforcement. As part of our ongoing Below the 10 project, David Weinberg brings us part two of a three-part series on the peacemakers of South Los Angeles.
Skip Townsend hears a lot of really terrible stories.
It's part of his job, creating a safe environment for people to come and talk about what they're going through. Like tonight, for instance. He's at a weekly meeting in the basement of a church at 35th and Normandy. At the front of the room, a woman named Kelly Dillon is telling her story. It's brutal and tragic. For years, her husband beat her badly, burned her with a clothes iron, and raped her until she couldn't take it anymore. At 19 years old, she shot and killed her husband and then spent 15 years in prison. But at the moment, Skip Townsend is not listening to her.
When she starts talking, I can't take it. And that's what happens when people unburden themselves. A person like me, I'm soaking it up, and it affects me. So I have to disconnect.
In order to disconnect, he clings to this thought, like a man adrift at sea clutching a life preserver. He's afraid that if he lets go of this thought and focuses on Kelly's story, he might break down in tears. And the thought is this: what if Red Lobster sold pancakes?
What would a lobster pancake taste like? So as I'm thinking this and going through whatever, I'm detaching myself.
As difficult as these group meetings are for Skip, they're a necessary part of his holistic approach to reducing violence. He also works with the Los Angeles Police Department as a gang interventionist. Interventionists are former gang members who act as first responders to violent crimes, trying to prevent retaliatory killings. They deal with people who are angry or grieving, young men proving themselves, mothers whose worst fears have been realized. It's painful, dangerous work. And the pay is terrible. Skip used to make really good money transporting cars for celebrities, but something didn't feel right.
I felt like I was doing something wrong. I was making money and I wasn't helping the community. So people in my community were still being shot. My children started gangbanging. My older kids started gangbanging, living the same lifestyle and culture. And at that point, I realized that this lifestyle is not about me.
Skip reached out to activists in the community who were working to reduce violence, and they became his mentors. He founded his own nonprofit, Second Call, which works to address the root causes of violence.
And it's much more rewarding, much more fulfilling. And I may not have a street named after me or a park bench or something, but I know that I have saved lives.
To understand how and why Skip saves lives, it helps to know a bit about him. He's tall, he wears reading glasses, he has a shaved head, and he can command a room when he speaks. But he's also a little goofy. He jokes and smiles a lot. As a kid, growing up in South Central, Skip was bullied a lot, mostly by older kids, many of whom were gang members. And one day, when he was 13 years old, he just had enough.
One of the older guys had said, just give me your money. Give me your money because the Crips are going to take your money. And when the Crips take your money, they're going to beat you up. So I got frustrated and said, man, I don't give a damn about the Crips. It's time for me to fight.
This was a big turning point in Skip's life. His decision to stand up for himself meant that from this point on, he would be labeled a rival gang member by the Crips.
Joining a gang wasn't actually joining a gang, signing up to, I want to be a gang member. It was just the commitment to fight back, the commitment to be a part of the community that wasn't going to be victimized by Crips. And it's just being willing and ready to say, I'm going to be the aggressor. I'm no longer going to be aggressed upon. I'm the aggressor now.
So how do you make that happen once you decide that?
Well, once I decide that I'm going to fight back, it's very simple. I just go to the mall because they're there. The Crips are there. And instead of turning my pockets inside out, showing them I didn't have any money, they had already took it all. At this point, when they ask how much money I have in my pocket, I tell them I got $1 million. Get it. You know, come get it. I got your money in my pocket. It's time for you to get it.
As a teenager getting into fights, Skip could hold his own, even against the older kids. And he developed a reputation for his ability to fight.
It becomes more like competition. We were younger, 13, 14. Everybody wanted to fight the best fighter. And as we got older, they started shooting each other. And it completely changed.
Skip dropped out of high school in the 11th grade, but he lied on a job application, said he had a diploma, and got hired in the mailroom of the real estate developer Kaufman and Broad.
About this time, 82, 83, the drugs really hit the community, and so many people were selling drugs and making thousands of dollars as opposed to me making $35 or $40 a day. So I immediately hit the street and started selling drugs. And that became my life, my downfall, and everything that dictated where I went after that.
At 17 years old, Skip became a full-fledged member of the Rolling 20s gang, a set of bloods from the West Adams neighborhood. He was in and out of jail for selling drugs and stealing cars, and he did this for over a decade, basically his whole adult life to that point. Then, at 34, he changed. He was arrested again, but this time it was big. He was facing 2 life sentences on an attempted murder charge he says he didn't commit. But he was held in jail for nearly a year.
Lost probably about 20 pounds going to jail. I went in with long black hair, came out with short gray hair. My father passed away. It was probably one of the worst times of my life. And as I said, knowing that I wasn't the person they said I was, but I still had some things that were in the closet, some things that had never been uncovered that I was wrong for doing. So I gave it to God and said, you know, this must be my fate.
At the trial, the victim testified. He said that Skip was not the person who shot him. 2 jurors still found Skip guilty, and the trial ended in a hung jury. Skip thinks it never should have been that close.
So when I saw that, I'm thinking to myself, what I want to do is protect myself and not allow myself to ever be in a situation where people who don't know me can make a decision, a permanent decision, on my life.
Skip quit selling drugs, quit stealing cars, stopped associating with the Rolling 20s, and he went back to school.
I went to Cal State LA. I went to Trade Technical College. I went to started taking the study of human behavior. I started studying my angry behaviors and why I was like that, and also started facilitating groups where it's just emotionally a safe environment for individuals to share how they feel. Then other communities found out, and before you know it, now we have 3 classes in the prison and 3 classes in the street and 1 in Pasadena, and we're just constantly growing.
In 2008, Skip started working as a gang interventionist with LAPD Lieutenant Michael Carradine. Carradine grew up in South LA and later became a beat cop there and went on to create the department's gang intervention program. He's slim and handsome with piercing green eyes. And that's how he got the nickname Green-Eyed Mike when he was a patrol cop. Today, he sometimes works with Skip out on the street.
And one of the things that Skip can do is he can go into a community, and because of the reputation that he has, you know, he can bring certain parties together to try to resolve any type of issues that they may have that may contribute to, say, a violent act or whatever the case may be.
Those violent acts that Skip tries to prevent can take place after a crime or at a neighborhood gathering, a funeral, for instance, or a vigil.
This is what I do.
On a Wednesday evening this past November, yeah. I met up with Skip at one of those vigils in a park in the West Adams neighborhood where he grew up. The gathering was in honor of a man who'd shot himself the week before. Skip stood in a prayer circle with a couple dozen people, many of them members of the Rolling Twenties, the same gang that Skip used to be a member of.
Always we miss you, Gutter.
We miss nice. You, Gutter.
We love you. We love you. Oh, Jesus, oh, amen.
Nice.
Nice.
After the prayer, everyone scattered into smaller groups, started making plans for the evening. Kids rushed over to the playground. Skip stood off to the side, away from everyone, and looked out on the scene from under his hoodie. One reason he's here is to prevent any rival gangs from showing up to victimize the people at this vigil.
Because what happens times like this is they become a target. They're a target for other communities that might want to come by and say, oh, you got a whole bunch of them at the park. And they creep up through the alleys, or they'll come through here and start shooting.
Skip is also here in case law enforcement shows up. Even though he already let them know about the vigil, in this neighborhood, large gatherings like this often attract police.
Normally what they would do, see this many people in the park, they would come up and just like anybody else who wants to violate this community would come up and come from two angles and kind of trap you in the park.
So you feel like part of your role is actually to protect people here from the police in a way?
I don't want to say protect people from the police, but I need to be that cushion between the police. The police, of course, know protocol and procedure, and the community doesn't know that protocol and procedures. So it's just a matter of being bilingual.
The other reason Skip is here is to try and get people to come to his classes.
Do my best to supply resources, you know, and talk about resources.
In his role as an interventionist, Skip often acts as a first responder to violent crimes. When someone has been shot in his community, he'll show up and work the crowd, try to find out why the shooting occurred so he can prevent a retaliatory killing. He often finds himself standing over the body of someone he knew or the child of a friend, and this type of work takes a toll on a person. One incident that happened a while back almost made Skip walk away from intervention work altogether.
Labor Day last year, 2014, there's a young man named James who has been shot in the head. He's deceased, and the community is in an uproar.
Skip did his best to calm everyone down, and then someone in the crowd got a phone call. It was from some of the younger members of the community who called to say that they had just gone out and gotten revenge for the killing of James.
And the older people in the group were high-fiving and, you know, like giving accolades to that, and I was just so sick to my stomach. And I was thinking, had I been there earlier, I could have maybe prevented it.
Several cars pulled up to the scene, and the kids who Skip believes had just gone out and committed the retaliatory killing got out and started celebrating.
And as I looked at the group, I didn't want to be around them and hang with them. And I looked over in the corner, and I seen another group that was smoking weed, and they were drinking hard liquor. And I was thinking to myself, if I stay here on this corner, I belong in that group. It's a group that is self-medicating because this reality is too harsh. And I'm not ready to go sit on a corner and smoke and drink all day simply because I can't deal with the issues that's going on.
So if you don't drink, what did you do to deal with that?
I just mask it. I just cover it up. I pretend like it doesn't bother me. And then it comes out months later, years later. It's bottled up emotion. So I talk it out to get it out as much as possible. That's why I'm sharing it now.
The other thing that helps Skip is working with people in the community who are trying to stop violence. People like Sister Lita Heron, a 69-year-old grandmother of six who co-hosts a radio show with Skip. She came to this work unexpectedly. In the 1980s, she was a typical mom trying to raise a family in South Central.
We're married, we have a home, we're trying to build a family, we were trying to live the American dream.
Lita, her husband, and their kids lived in a beautiful house that was built in 1909. Lita's husband had a good job at Lockheed Martin, and life was good. Until one day, nearly 30 years ago, a bullet came flying through their stained glass window.
Our first response was to duck, you know, and that's what we did.
The shootings kept happening, and slowly, Lita's fear turned into anger, and she could no longer duck and hide in fear.
I got angry, you know, as a mother. How dare you? Who are you? I want to see you. I want to know what you look like. I want to know what your car looks like. I want to know which way you came from and which way you left. So that's what drove me out to the front porch to have a look. So that's when I became a witness.
Tomorrow, we will air the story of Sister Lita Heron and her role in the struggle to end violence in Los Angeles in the third and final piece in this series. I'm David Weinberg for KCRW.
You can hear the entire series at belowthe10.com. KCRW's Below the 10 project is supported by a grant from the Conrad and Hilton Foundation. And Warren Olney is here now to give us a preview of what's happening at 1 o'clock.
Well, what's happening at 1 o'clock is we are going to look into the question of ISIS and what can we do about ISIS, particularly in the aftermath of the attacks in Europe. And it turns out today the New York Times has a very lengthy story about how far back the planning for those strikes goes, years before we even knew that ISIS existed. So the notion that they came about because we've been pushing ISIS around in some way and reducing the size of the caliphate is not very accurate. We're also going to be looking at the question of whether the U.S., in fact, and the West in general, can militarily do anything to put an end to ISIS. And we're going to hear some very interesting information from a woman who has interviewed 500 terrorists, including 25 who have defected from ISIS, and found out exactly what motivated them, how they were recruited, how that came about, and how everyone at the end of their training had to behead somebody.
Oh, my gosh. And are these mainly men from Europe or from all over?
Some are from Europe. Most are not. But enough are from Europe that it obviously there's a very disturbing situation there. And that's one of the reasons for raising the question about whether the military is going to do any good, because there are so many disaffected people who are vulnerable to the kind of training, the kind of propaganda, the kind of effort that ISIS has gotten so good at launching who are in Europe already and vulnerable to their appeal, that it's time for a new strategy.
Okay. That's coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. Thank you. And coming up on this program, an audit finds that California students did not get into the UC of their choice, many of them, because spots were taken by foreign students who paid a lot more tuition. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. A state audit released today reveals that when the University of California admits out-of-state students, it puts in-state students at a disadvantage. That's especially true for students of color. The UC's motive is money. Students from out-of-state pay significantly higher tuition than in-state residents, about $23,000 more per student. Governor Brown has been wrangling with UC President Janet Napolitano over this issue for years. Citing budget constraints, the UC has tripled the number of non-residents in the past decade. And the audit claims that in order to do that, they have lowered academic standards for those students. The audit was requested by Assemblyman Mike Gibson. He's a Democrat from Carson, and he's on the line now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. So why did you call for this audit in the first place?
It was important based on just hearing from students not having the ability to go to a California school. And so we voted to send the state auditor in to do a forensic audit of what was going on. And today I just got briefed, and I would simply say I am very upset. I am very upset with her findings that clearly indicate a tremendous disparity and a lack of respect for students in California.
Why do you say this is a tremendous lack of respect for the students of California? Janet Napolitano, UC president, is blasting this audit, saying, look, without these out-of-state students paying this higher tuition, we couldn't admit as many in-state students as we do now, or we'd have to raise their tuition significantly. So they're actually a good thing for the students of California.
Well, I don't know where she's coming from when making that kind of remarks. I know that students in California are not allowed to are not being treated fairly. Slots are being filled with out-of-state students. It has increased over the years by 432% of out-of-state enrollment. Where's the fairness in that? And I'm very concerned with the fact that she can't realize that.
Well, she's saying, look, it's you guys in the legislature for cutting our funding 33%. She said the UC system has had to withstand that level of a budget cut over the years.
Well, it's not the first time it happened, and they have been able to manage. As a matter of fact, they have used other ways to develop cost-saving measures to save money. The UC's developed the Working Smart Initiative to redirect savings and budgets more in a very strategic fashion. There's other ways out there that they can still take care of California students and still maintain a robust budget, and they're not doing that.
And what are some of those ways?
Well, look at when the state cut the funding across the board, not just when the UCs and the CSUs, but across the board, there was ways of saving money that they implemented. They actually saved money as a result of some of those ways that they implemented, they came up with to making sure that they can continue to maintain a level of service as a UC. And so those are some of the ways that they developed to, again, cut costs and also remain very vibrant. And so it's still the same way they could be, those things could be done right now.
So are you saying cutting salaries or cutting bureaucratic
Well, they are
waste?
Very high. They are very high when it comes down to salaries and management as relates to the provost, the chancellors. All of those individuals are making exorbitant salaries. Hell, if I'm not mistaken, she makes more money than the President of the United States. And certainly the governor of the state of California is not getting paid what she's being paid. I am clearly stating a fact that the legislature, once we give money to the UCs, they do whatever they want to do with it. And I think that's unfair to the taxpayers of the state of California as well as our students.
So what's happening to these students? Are they not getting into any UC, or are they just not getting into the UC of their choice?
No, what's happening to these students, California students, when they get accepted, they're not giving their choice. Their choice is being totally disregarded. When it comes down to students out of state, they're giving their first choice as their priority. They're giving, you know, their number one school, they're getting that school to be accepted to. Students in California, they're not giving their first choice, and they're right here in California. And that's a huge disparity. And it's a huge disparity when it comes down to, you know, kids who are unrepresented. And so we need to look at how do we address this particular issue. The state auditor has clearly delineated to me in her briefing today some recommendations, very key recommendations, on potentially capping out-of-state or residents coming into California. Do you happen to know that the UC spent nearly $5 million on recruiting non-residents during the time period? It tried to increase funding for non-residents.
I did not know that.
Yeah, $5 million to go out to recruit students from out of California into California.
Well, I can imagine what the response to that would be, that that's money well spent, because, as I said earlier, their chief complaint is they're not getting adequate funding from the state legislature.
I think we can go back and forth on that all day long. Our kids are going totally being underserved. Our kids are being disenfranchised by a system that they're relying on, and that's grossly unfair.
Okay, so capping out-of-state students, what else is the auditor recommending?
The auditor is recommending improving internal operations, promoting savings related to employees' costs, and monitoring campus spending. Right now, when a campus get a budget, they do whatever they want with that budget with total disregard. I mean, there is no monitoring. There is no checks and balances. And it has to be checks and balances among taxpayers' money. I think that's the very least that our taxpayers want to receive, is that their money is being used in a very appropriate and efficient manner. And right now, based on the auditor's report, they're not getting what they're being paid for.
Okay, so quickly, what's next?
Well, I'm encouraging the chair, the new chair of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, which is Assemblymember Freddie Rodriguez, to call for an oversight hearing. I believe the taxpayers of California deserve a very robust, open, and transparent public meeting to discuss, one, the auditor's report, with the auditor being present, and also have Ms. Napolitano come to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee and answer questions of the committee on the report that the audit has revealed.
All right, Assemblyman Mike Gibson, a Democrat from Carson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Julie Myers, here with the listener feedback.
Yes, and they want to talk about the UC system today. Mike McGill says that his state taxes go to the UC system and should be going to benefit Californians exclusively. He says, isn't the point of public school to benefit the residents of that state? Out-of-state and foreign rich kids can go to private schools like the University of Southern California. He refers to it as the University of Spoiled Children. Come on, Mike McGill. Rocio Hernandez says that there's great value in regional diversity, though. Californians benefit from having friends who are from somewhere else. They pay a lot more than in-state students, so they're subsidizing the in-state students to some extent. That's a lot of S's. I made it through.
That's Napolitano's argument.
Exactly. Exactly. And we also had Alva Ortega weigh in, and she says that you can't cut funding and then expect the money to come out of nowhere. If you are actually concerned about this, restore funding to the UC system.
All right. Good point. And if you have any points to make, we would love to hear them. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Our phone number is 1-844-PRESSPLAY. And of course, we're on Facebook. Julie Myers, thank you very much. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brown. I'll see you tomorrow.